Hello, everybody. This is Daniela Bien-Aimé, and welcome to another episode of the Bien-Aimé Post Podcast. Hello, everybody. Good evening. Hello. This is Daniela, and I am thrilled to actually have another episode of the Bien-Aimé Post. I am actually going to be joined tonight by Mr. Rick Willard, and he is definitely a first mover in this topic that we are going to talk about. But before we do so Mr. Rick Willard is the founder of the Agentic Group, and it is a New York-based federation of over 50 blockchain companies worldwide. And he is also the interim CEO of Global Blockchain Technologies, a publicly traded blockchain investment firm. The Agentic Group promotes the blockchain ecosystem through education, consulting, and deployment within the private and public sectors. He is a fellow at the Foreign Policy Association, an advisor to the Field Center for Entrepreneurship at Brewer College, and he's also appointed on a number of boards and throughout New York City. His speaking engagements include events for the World Web Forum, the European Union IP Summit, Finance, the Emerging Links Blockchain Series, Harvard Business School, Dow Jones, and Davos 2018, which you are actually with there this year. First of all, thank you so much for joining me. We've been trying to get this show together for the past 3 months, and I'm very, very appreciative of your flexibility, and we finally were able to make it happen. I want to touch a little bit about, I'm hoping that what you can do tonight, the way that I want to frame this conversation, I'm already getting some questions. I have a couple of questions from some of my readers. I want to be able to actually share them, ask them as well. Before we begin, I want to read this quote that you actually shared during one of your speeches, which I thought was really great in terms of setting us up tonight to do this show. And you basically said, I'm looking at my notes here, so bear with me. Mm-hmm. You said, you know, what happens when money is no longer scarce? When money is no longer an option, when money is no longer an impediment, what happens? And I think it's a powerful question, because I think the entire concept of the cryptocurrency is sort of like is giving a lot of people some hope in terms of access to finance. And I like to think that my work, what I do, inspires a different Haiti to the highest level of discussion. That is why I actually asked you to come to speak with us tonight, because some of the conversations that we need to have about Haiti, they need to be at a higher level. And one of the ways that this can be done is by paying attention to how the world is evolving through technology. And the ideas of cryptocurrency, blockchain and Bitcoin, yes, they are. Bitcoin is still around, which I have a question about that as well. They are part of the global conversation, and I really believe that Haiti needs to be part of the discussion. And you are definitely one of the people, as I said before, that can bring this discussion to also to a higher level. You are well-versed in the subject matter. In addition to that, you are a practitioner. I'm told that you live what you preach when it comes to the subject. You have been traveling quite a bit to speak on the topic. You have been very busy so far this year. You were at Davos. You were also in January. You were also at the World Crypto Economic Forum in San Francisco. And just last month, you were in Zurich at the International Blockchain Leadership Summit to speak on the topic. So I am thrilled to have you here. The first question, well, I guess, the way that, yes, go ahead.
No, please. I was just going to say that I'm actually thrilled to be here. And just very briefly, the attention, say, being paid to Puerto Rico post-hurricane is commendable in some ways, but I think that you're right in that this is a global conversation. So that means that Haiti is inclusive in that conversation, and to, you know, to pick out one island over others is questionable. And I'm glad to have the opportunity to speak with your listeners, about Haiti in particular, because I think that it's been overlooked in lots of these conversations.
Well, that's why I decided to have you, because I know that you would be open to having this discussion, and I'm very appreciative of that. So I guess the first thing we can do just to begin is, can you talk to us a little bit about how you got involved with Bitcoin, blockchain, and cryptocurrency? Those are some of the things that I would love to know, but I'm sure that my listeners would love to know as well. Walk us through how you got involved.
Right. So I got involved actually by happenstance. In 2011, a friend of mine, who turned out to be one of the co-founders of the initial Bitcoin Alliance in Seattle, Washington, Bitcoin Foundation, pardon me, I took him to lunch, and we were talking, and at the end of the session, the lunch, he said, I want to pay you back. And I said, well, that's unnecessary. It's $50. It's not going to kill me. And he said, no, I want you to see something. And he then took my iPhone. He downloaded the blockchain wallet, which was the first wallet for Bitcoin, first phone-based wallet. And then he downloaded a certain amount of Bitcoin on my phone and said, that's for you. And I was intrigued with it because I come from my first life was marketing technologies. And to me, it looked like what an amazing loyalty point platform. I really just took it for face value. I didn't understand the ecosystem yet. It was very early in the game. Hardly anyone understood the ecosystem, really. But it looked to me like this was a way to transfer value, and it could be almost any type of value. But I didn't know yet what I was really thinking. So I spent about 3 months. I locked myself in a room, pretty much, and studied. I read the Satoshi White Paper, which is the document that started Bitcoin as a movement. And I tried to wrap my head around what this new form of value was and how the internet made it possible for us to transfer value at a peer-to-peer basis without banks, without third-party intermediaries of any kind. So it dawned on me that the internet was going to make this possible in one way or another. So we then opened up a think tank. We started a think tank called Mint Combine in 2012. To address the possibilities of the space. So I gathered around a lot of people who I thought to be intelligent and thoughtful on this subject. And that's how I started.
Interesting. Wow. So I guess the next thing that I want to sort of like touch base with you quickly is that you've been sort of like, I think you were an early adopter because you've been in the space for, from what I gather from just doing research, for almost for a little over 6 years. Mm-hmm. And the idea of cryptocurrency is not even 10 years old yet. I think it's about 9 years old. At least Bitcoin is about 9. So let me understand, because one of the things that I think, and when you're dealing with a country like Haiti, it's very complex. And there are a lot, most people don't have access to a lot, but yet the country is very rich, which we'll talk about in a little bit. When you are dealing with a country where it's rich in assets, such as agriculture, tourism, culture, and dignity, yes, I think dignity is a form of an asset, mm-hmm. but the country is poor in cash, right? The country is poor in cash. How can a technology like blockchain reverse this trend of poor in cash?
Mm-hmm. Well, you're right. And sort of central to this conversation is the concept of value, right? Because money, or fiat money as we describe it, state-controlled money, is based on creating scarcity in the marketplace. So, you know, banks are part of that. They only give to certain people. If you're wealthy, it's easy to get a loan. If you're poor, it's hard to get a loan. It's very expensive to be poor. So when you have assets, though, when you have, let's say, lumber or any other kind of tangible asset, maybe that's cultural. Maybe that's, you know, it can take many forms. Then you have the basis of a marketplace. You go out and you essentially, like everyone else in the world, make that asset available to others. Again,
right.
Be it tourism, be it lumber, be it bauxite, be it anything, right? So when you can use that as your peg or as the basis of your asset, then you have essentially a fungible or tradable asset. And that right now we call it US dollar or renminbi or the euro. But it doesn't have to be called that. You have your own.
Right.
It goes for nation states, which are used to that, or it goes also to groups of individuals, to communities. Every community is actually an economic ecosystem, which means that it's an economy. So the lumber community in Haiti or other communities, cultural community, can actually use the blockchain to tokenize their asset and make that available to the world to purchase based on the belief that that has merit and it will grow in size and influence over the internet, which makes that possible.
Interesting. Interesting. Now, somebody has just sent a question, and I'm going to get to you in a minute. Three questions just came up, but I want to sort of like set the stage a little bit so you can sort of like give us, a comprehensive background, if you will, on the entire blockchain, right? So the next question that I have is, how does one go about creating a blockchain application? And that's going to lead me to one of the questions that a reader just asked. And if you can sort of like, give us an overview, because there are a lot of terms. You're talking about blockchain, cryptocurrency, tokens, or coins, and that can get very, very complicated. And I know you can, because I've actually listened, follow your work and listen to you. If you can sort of like give us an overview from your perspective, how, like, what is blockchain? Like, what is cryptocurrency? Can you bring us to that, you know, to that conversation?
Sure. pardon me. So when we speak of cryptocurrency, or a cryptocurrency is, and token are interchangeable words. A cryptocurrency is a brand of token. Bitcoin is a brand of token that lives on a blockchain. Now, a blockchain is essentially, there are different flavors of blockchains, so let's just stick with Bitcoin for the time being. This is how it all came about. So on the Bitcoin blockchain, Bitcoin is mined. How it's created and brought into existence is essentially what we call mining. And what you do in mining is you take your computer. Now you have to have a very high-powered computer or array of computers. In the beginning, you just needed one little computer. And you essentially download a program, and that program tries to answer a mathematical riddle. That mathematical riddle is increasingly hard to answer. So you have people around the world with their computers buying, their computers are working and cycling to answer that mathematical riddle. The first one that does is awarded a block of token. Okay? So
okay.
Now, then we go to the next block. That block may have, you know, in the beginning, it may have had 500 tokens in it. Now I think it may have 20 in it. But we'll talk about that in a second. So you are awarded this block. Now then it starts all over again. So every miner around the world now buys and competes to be the first to mine the next block. And you do that enough times, and you have a chain of blocks. That's what we refer to as the blockchain. Okay, it is a string of transactions that essentially each block awarding a number of tokens, in this case, for this discussion, Bitcoin tokens, to the winner of that mining competition. So that's how Bitcoin is mined. Like I said in the beginning, it was fairly easy to do because it gets harder. The riddle gets harder every block that's formed. So now it takes a lot of computing power to answer that riddle. And so you have people in North America, in China, in Bermuda, in different places around the world, throwing millions of dollars into mining facilities, in some cases $90 million, into a mining facility with a vast array of computers that are trying to solve these riddles. And this is why you see the appreciation in cost or in the price of Bitcoin, because it's harder and harder to do and harder to get. If you have your, you know, if you just download the Bitcoin protocol and try to answer that riddle today with a home computer, maybe you'll get a part of, you'll get a block in the next 20, 30 years. But these people are getting blocks every day, so it takes a massive amount of computing power. So that's what a blockchain is. I'm sorry, go on.
No. That's good. I think one thing that I want to add and I want to ask you about is a lot of people are very skeptical about Bitcoin. They said it's not really sustainable, specifically mm-hmm. because of the electricity problem.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it's. I think the last price that I actually saw was like it was $7,000 per Bitcoin. That's how many. That's how much one Bitcoin was worth.
Mm-hmm.
So, in your opinion, is Bitcoin dying? Is it dead? Is it? Do you think there's a future for Bitcoin? I mean, I know there's a difference between Bitcoin and the other cryptocurrencies like Litecoin and Ethereum.
Sure. Well. You know, that's a good question. Let me address the electricity issue first. You have two dynamics at play. It is energy intensive to mine Bitcoin these days because you have these vast computer centers doing it. However, at the same time, you see, people tend to look at this in a bubble. It isn't Bitcoin alone that's having an effect. We also are looking at a world where energy is becoming cheaper and cheaper by the day. And any inflation in energy prices is simply inflated by the providers of that energy. Energy is actually getting much, much cheaper all around the world. So these two things are actually colliding. But because of this fixed price of energy in certain places and the fact that some companies simply way overcharge for energy, then that makes it look like Bitcoin is using all of this energy and somehow sucking up the world's energy. In fact, that's not exactly true. But is the second part of your question. Is Bitcoin a fad? I will answer it this way. When automobiles were first invented, let's just say it's arguable, but let's say Henry Ford in the United States built the first conveyor belt car. He revolutionized car making for sure with a conveyor belt. So it gave us the Model T Ford. Okay, the Model T Ford was essentially a piece of junk by today's standards. It was hard to start. People would break their hands or wrists trying to start it with that crank in the middle, in the front of the car. It often broke down on the road. So people would say things like, get a horse. This car is a fad. I don't know what's wrong with you. Well, think of Bitcoin as a Model T Ford. And you see this proliferation, this flowering of all these other currencies. And if you say that, okay, first there was a Model T Ford, then there was a Chevrolet, then there was a Maserati, right? State of the art.
Right.
So we're getting to the point where we're refining the not only the development of the technology of blockchain-based tokens, but also their use cases as we go along. So we're on the path to building those Ferraris. Bitcoin itself, will it go away? In my estimation, most likely it will go away. When will that be? It's very hard to predict. But it's only the beginning of an idea that really can't be stopped without turning off the entire internet.
Right. The thing that I think about is when the internet first came, sort of like to the masses, right? I remember AOL. Was sort of like the dominant mm-hmm. player, right?
Exactly.
Right. I don't know anyone who actually used AOL, so I can understand that. I can understand that concept. So talk to us then about the other I guess, blockchains that are sort of like replacing Bitcoin, that are becoming more competitive. I know that Litecoin is one. Thoughts about those two?
Well, Litecoin was invented as a fork, or rather a splinter off of the Bitcoin blockchain by a gentleman named Charlie Lee in California, who now I believe still works for Google. But the Litecoin was really, it was considered an altcoin or an alternative coin to Bitcoin. And it was mostly an experiment. Litecoin is, you know, if you look at it realistically, has very little value, except for the fact that it, the will of the cryptographic community, the crypto community, make it have value. And so now it does have value in terms of trading against other cryptocurrencies. But in real life, you can't spend Litecoin really for anything, right? So its value is debatable. It simply is. Again, all value systems are belief systems. We believe in the U.S. dollar because we believe the U.S. will grow. We believe in the now the renminbi in China because we believe China's economy is going to grow. Whenever you have that mass belief, you have value. And that value then is produced in terms of just tokens. In the old world, it was physical token, a coin, a dollar, whatever. Now, right, it's a digital token. So will Litecoin and Bitcoin, will any of these tokens be around in 10 years? Very few. I would venture to say that very few will be alive in 10 years, but they'll be replaced by something much more efficient and easier to use.
Interesting. So the idea of the cryptocurrency is what people should focus on, because under cryptocurrency, you can have different, it's almost like social media it's a broad term, but under social media, you have Facebook, you have Twitter, you have LinkedIn.
Exactly.
So as these players come, the ones who can actually, it's like the survival of the fittest, right? Those who can actually thrive and become efficient and provide value, they are the ones who will survive. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's right. Provide value. That's exactly correct. And, you know, that value comes in different forms when you're talking about a digital space. So every blockchain is trying, well, most blockchains, not every blockchain, most good blockchains and well-thought-out blockchains are trying to solve existing inefficiencies, both in the digital realm and in real life. So, for instance, when you look at supply chains for corporations, they're very inefficient. Blockchain can help with that, and that's probably another conversation. But then you can monetize that efficiency by issuing tokens against a supply chain that people could then invest in to build the supply chain even more robust. See, there are different ways of looking at blockchains and this token phenomenon that aren't just about getting a dollar and spending a dollar, but actually about solving problems that then creates new forms of value that other people can invest in, that regular people can invest in. You don't have to be a qualified investor, quote unquote. You can be an average person. And you can get the same kind of 30x return on your money, even though it may not be $1 million. You can get a high return on your money if you make the right investment. So it's democratizing investments in that way and creating new forms of value.
Excellent, excellent. And that's why I wanted to have you tonight, because I think one of the challenges, at least in my community, is that we too wait until something gets old.
Mm-hmm.
Before we find value in it. And I think that's wrong. I think, one of the things that this economy is teaching us is how to be open and how to pay attention to what's emerging on the horizon. And I do have a couple of questions, but I do want to also go to some of, I have one question from Facebook, and I'm going to read it. This gentleman says, in light of recent SEC, some banks blocking debit card purchases of cryptocurrency and the negative press of Bitcoin, what are the on the ramp of to purchase cryptocurrency? Which banks recognize the right to spend or even have money to buy Bitcoins or Ethereum, I guess? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? I don't know if that question makes sense.
Yes, it does make sense. I know what he's trying to ask me. Most banks in the world will not allow you to buy Bitcoin from their account. If you are linked up to an exchange of cryptocurrencies, many banks, once they find out, will delete your account. That's a fact.
Wow.
That's not true in the case of all banks. We have had some businesses that work with Bitcoin that say they even just get paid in Bitcoin. They don't even trade Bitcoin. Their accounts have been shut down. You know, these are regular businesses. So there's still a lot of fear and anxiety on the part of the banking institutions about, you know, they're asking the same questions, quite frankly, that your audience is asking. Is this going to stick around? Is this going to be a thing? You know, should I be in it or should I be wary of it? And should I be against it even? And so in light of, rather in lieu of making an actual decision, what they do is they just cut it off. Now, that is changing. I will say that many banks are now beginning to wrap their heads around this phenomenon and beginning to understand that there is value here. I was blown away just the other day when I was looking at my insurance website, just doing some maintenance on my own personal insurance, and I come to find out there was a button there that hadn't been there 3 months ago, which was a "We Accept Bitcoin" button. Now, I
fascinating.
That this insurance company was linked to the armed forces. My father was in the Air Force, and for it to be a U.S. government, at least affiliated insurance company that accepted Bitcoin was to me almost a miracle. I really almost fell out of my chair. So adoption is coming in different waves all around the world. There are banks in Switzerland that will accept Bitcoin or will not accept Bitcoin. There are, but increasingly, it's getting to be critical mass where banks and institutions are understanding that the idea of this is not going away. So Bitcoin is what they know most. So Bitcoin is what they will start to accept first. Now, maybe that means that Bitcoin never goes away. It's just refined over time. Or maybe something else better comes along. But I think that right now the question is well asked. Where can you buy this and how can you trade it? How can you hold it? There are places like Gibraltar that has a robust cryptocurrency exchange, the island of Gibraltar. The island of Bermuda in July will begin to initiate bank-backed cryptocurrency exchanges, meaning that for Bermuda is opening themselves up completely to this, which means that the banks there in Bermuda will accept accounts that are linked to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. So it's changing. That question 2 years ago would have been almost no bank on earth accepts Bitcoin. Now we can point to examples of where that's softening up and where mainstream is becoming a little bit more comfortable with this. In terms of the SEC, I'll say this briefly. The SEC is effectively a government hammer meant to keep people safe in their investments, and there's nothing wrong with that. But a hammer only sees nails. So in terms of the SEC, what they see is that every token is a security, like a stock or a securitized asset. And that's not the case. There are certain tokens allow you to use a certain service. Certain tokens allow you to get discounts on products, just like a loyalty point, right? Loyalty points have been around for many, many years, and they are used as currency in many cases. For instance, airplane miles can be, you can sell your airplane miles to somebody else for cash. This has been around for a long time. So loyalty points in that area are more strictly utility or access tokens and are generally seen not to be under the purview of the SEC. Even though the SEC would love to say all of it is a security, so you have to pay us $500,000 to get it properly registered by a lawyer and this and that. Well, that's not how this is going to play out over the long term.
Fascinating. Now, I have another question relating, this is relating to Haiti. And I think this is apropos since you also know quite a bit about some of this work that's being done in Africa when it comes to cryptocurrency. And the reader, let me just read it. It says, in the context that the majority of rural Haiti doesn't have access to banks, to any kind of credit unions or any conventional investment, can you explain how such participants would use smart contracts cryptocurrency to access such service. So I guess you probably want to give us a definition of smart contract as well. That was actually one of the questions that I actually had. So this is great.
Okay, so let's start there. A smart contract is essentially rules translated into code that reside within the blocks. The blocks that we went over earlier. You can actually program this token to do certain things. Let's just say in a really simple example, if you're going to buy a house and you put your money in escrow and then the person accepts, you sign a contract and the person accepts it, and when the contract is finished, the money is dispersed from escrow, right? So very similarly, a smart contract, in this case, if you're buying a house, the smart contract will hold the value in tokens of that sale and then automatically disperse it once the parameters have been met to complete the sale. Or the regular contracts have been signed, you know the money is there, or rather the value is there, and that whatever token it happens to be, okay, all the regulations have been met, all the criteria has been met, boom, it transfers automatically without the bank. So actually, the blockchain acts as the custodian of trust, which is why we call it a trust network many times. So it is, instead of the bank being the trusted third party, the blockchain is the trusted third party. Again, that's a very simple explanation, but it applies to many, many different things. Smart contracts are still being refined. And by the way, they're not new. Smart contracts have been around for at least 30 years without the blockchain. So in some cases, blockchain is bringing together technologies that existed separately and turning them into something else, something more powerful. Now, yes, there are problems with the banking infrastructure in Haiti and other economic infrastructure issues. But I would say that most people have a cell phone, some kind of cell phone. Just like many other parts in the world, some of which are very poor, you still find a pretty deep penetration in cell phones, maybe not 100%, but pretty significant. And if you have a cell phone, there is a way to receive and to transmit value in cryptocurrencies. For non-smartphones, it's a little bit tougher, but there are people who understand this, who are working on that technology right now to allow even people with regular feature phones, meaning not smartphones, to be able to trade in cryptocurrencies. So that day is coming relatively quickly. So the bank not having a banking infrastructure is almost a benefit in the cryptocurrency world for a place like Haiti, because you don't really need them anymore. And if you don't have them and you can trade value, you also get more of your value because banks take a certain percentage of any transaction. So you're paying, to send your money or to receive money. Well, that payment goes away to the bank and you get more full value that's being transmitted to you. A really good example of that is the world of remittance. And for your listeners who aren't familiar with that term, remittances, the diasporic payments back to the homeland. So Haitians that are living in America, in France, anywhere else, send money back home. They go, they work. My father was Jamaican, so I understand this very well. You go out, you work, and then you send money home to help your family. Right, this is the remittance, and it's a multi-billion-dollar business around the world. Multi-billion-dollar business, and
exactly.
It is so because Western Union and MoneyGram and these large corporations that specialize in wiring money, they can take anywhere from 12% to 30% of the money that you send in transmission fees. Think about that: 12% to 30%, and you wonder why areas stay poor. Because they're not getting the full value of what's being sent home. An associate of mine, Elizabeth Rossiello, who's from New York and was an executive at Citibank, I believe, went to Kenya a few years ago, about almost 5 years ago now, and after about a year and a half, convinced the government to allow her to use the Bitcoin protocol for remittance. Now, she could only get a license from the UK to Kenya, but that's a pretty big chunk of money that gets sent back to Kenya every year. So using the Bitcoin protocol, meaning no banks, not one of the seven layers that a remittance has to go through, and each takes a little piece, which makes it very, very high, a high percentage to send the money, she could do it for 3%, meaning that you know, anywhere from 11 to 27% more money gets back to Kenya from the UK when they use that service. Now, look at what happened to Kenya's middle class in the last 3 years. It grew significantly. Do they still have some issues? Absolutely. But there's a bigger swath of people, of Kenyans, are living better, all because of BitPesa, this company? No. But it's because more remittance is getting into the country. People can spend more money at home. Businesses can grow. And that is the whole cycle of the economy. So it certainly had a part to play in that.
Well, I'm so glad you said that, because as a Haitian, I send money home, and my parents send money home, my dad particularly. And it's so true. Every time you send money home, the MoneyGram and they take about 30%, and it's really, I understand it's business, but that's like a big chunk of somebody's money that you're taking away, and for what? No one really understands what that money is used for, right?
Right.
The other thing at the moment, I'm assuming when we're dealing with the back end of blockchain, because you said, I understand it's a ledger, right? So is it mostly numbers, and how does that translate into different languages? Because Haiti, Haiti, you know, has like at least 3 different languages. And then now we have a lot of Haitians who speak Spanish. So explain to me a little bit, if you can, about, you know, how does Bitcoin, I mean, not Bitcoin specifically, but blockchain and cryptocurrency, how would that work from the back end in terms of languages?
Well, you know, it really helps to speak English. I'm not going to lie.
Okay.
The protocol is written in English, but it's very simple English. You know, computer programming uses the very, very simplest of languages. And in many cases, use of language, and in many cases, it makes up its own syntax and language. So it may not make sense if you say it in English, but computer code itself, it's like learning any other language, right? Number one, it's numbers, and that language is the same all over the world. And it's certain phrases. That means a computer does certain things. You could, you know, and people have, you know, throughout the decades, you can read a French book about computer programming language, and even though that computer programming language happens to be written using the English language as its base, you're just learning new words that could be any language. So it doesn't matter that it's English so much. It matters that you understand what the code is supposed to do, and you use the proper word and numerical sequence for it. Does that make sense?
No, it does. It does. I imagine, because it's interesting, a couple of months ago, I had a chance to interview the Haiti's former prime minister, and he's actually due to come back again. And we're trying to arrange that schedule. But when we spoke last, he was actually telling us that there's a restaurant in Haiti that was getting ready to start taking Bitcoin. So I'm very curious to find out, you know, how that's happening and who's actually writing the code for that. That's very interesting.
Well, you wouldn't have to necessarily write code for that. There are Bitcoin wallets that exist. You can simply download onto your phone or pad or computer. And there's the Bitcoin themselves, which you don't necessarily need to know how to program. That being said, I implore your listeners, those of you who are technology-minded or talented, to absolutely learn how to code cryptocurrencies. It's important that people of color do not miss this. This is, you know, when Web 1.0 came about, we talked about a digital divide, meaning the quote-unquote first world and the quote-unquote developing world, that the first world was going to just leave, you know, these other countries behind. And to a great extent, a lot of us fought to make computers accessible to people of color and to people, not only just people of color, but people who didn't have as much. Now, that was okay. And it was important, but the more important thing is this is a value revolution. This is beyond money. It's about, it touches everything that, for instance, you talk about the cultural assets of Haiti. Well, you know, to make those cultural assets even more relevant to the world in this day and age, you're going to have to monetize them. You're going to have to, you have to make them have value. And that's one of the promises of this revolution, or this evolution at least, is that you can now do that. But if you're left behind in it, then not only, you know, will things not change, they could possibly get very much worse, because the rest of the world would be moving forward, and you'd be stuck. So I, you know, really suggest that anybody in Haiti, wherever they are, is technically minded, who knows how to code or wants to learn how to code, do so. Go to GitHub, G-I-T-H-U-B, on the internet, and play around with the Bitcoin protocol, and play around with other protocols that are out there for tokens, and, you know, wrap your head around it, get to understand it, ask people questions, other developers in the GitHub, and they'll answer your questions. Developers love to share, but do so immediately.
Wow, thank you for that. I definitely agree, and this is why I want to have these conversations, because I don't want the community to miss out. I certainly don't want to miss out, but I also don't want the community to miss out. Now I'm going to go back to one reader. Again, this is coming from Facebook. Let me just scroll down here. So the third question is, your 50 blockchain federations that you actually currently, your 50 blockchain federations that you're actually running right now, you're leading that organization. The question is, do they operate as a consortium blockchain based on Ethereum? And if so, is it a consortium blockchain centralized? If not Ethereum based, how do you have smart contracts?
Well, you can build smart, you can set Ethereum based. Well, you can have smart contracts in any blockchain that's programmed to do so. It doesn't have to be Ethereum. Ethereum pushes smart contracts and touts that as their main strength, the fact is you can make contracts, you know, on the Bitcoin blockchain. You can make contracts on any blockchain that you decide you want to make contracts on. But the all blockchains pretty much will accept smart contracts unless they're closed off for some other reason. That's the whole point of them. As far as the federation goes, Agentic Group was formed, my company was formed, in the beginning, of course, after we had the think tank, no one knew what these were. I mean, you know, you have, your audience has questions, but they actually have, you know, intelligent, relevant questions. If you think about 5 years ago, 6 years ago, no one even knew what questions to ask. So what we would do as the umbrella company to the Federation, Agentic Group went out, we spoke to corporations, we spoke to countries, we spoke to, you know, the governments, and we spoke to lots of large entities and said, here's what's happening. And so we would then consult with those large entities. But in consulting, of course, we created gaps. We said, okay, here's what could happen if you had this technology, and this would happen, and then you could look at this as a proof of concept, et cetera, et cetera. And once we got to that phase where, okay, the corporation or the country had accepted that this is something that they want to do, then who's going to do it? So we would then, you know, look to our federation members, of which there are different kinds of blockchain developers, and say, well, these two or three are really good at this particular kind of application. And then we would introduce the federation members to the client, and then allow them to then, you know, may the best team win in that case. So what we did is we tried to build the ecosystem by creating work for these companies that no one knew even what to ask them to do. Right? We created the questions that the client could ask and the scenarios by which they could benefit, and then brought the companies with us to better fulfill the technology.
Excellent, excellent. This is Bien-Aimé Post, and we are getting ready to wind down. Thank you so much, Rick, for being here.
Thank you.
A few more minutes, and if you want to call and ask a question, you can definitely call the 646-668-2530 and press 1 to actually ask your question, because we have about 5 more minutes and then before we wrap up. I want to transition to some practicalities and some of the things that are emerging. One of the things that I'm noticing about cryptocurrency is that it's very fluid and it's evolving. It's volatile. It's really intense. And I want to talk about in terms, and again, you don't have to go into any details in terms of your company's investment, but following your work, you seem to think that the ICO space is quite a niche. Like you really think there's a lot of opportunities in that area. Can you tell us why, or can you give us an example of one of the companies that you've actually worked with that you think is doing well or has been doing well?
Well, there are a few. Ethereum itself was an ICO. That's doing very well.
Okay.
But I'll give you an example. The whole point of creating this value where communities can own their own form of value and tokenize that and have it be monetized through that vehicle is the whole point behind an ICO. When it first started, it was about a technology platform that could be used to change the world, that's it, which most of them said. Well, that was funded initially by these new Bitcoin millionaires and close to millionaires who saw their Bitcoin rise in value. So they would pump their money back into, you know, different kinds of platforms that they thought might work. Now we're going mainstream with this. And what it really does is instead of the investors being, you know, simply developers and technologists and coders, we're seeing regular people. One of the benefits of this movement is it democratizes access to investment so that in the show, you don't have to be an accredited investor, like meaning you don't have to have, at least in the U.S. Example of accredited investor, $250,000 to just throw away. That determines an accredited investor in the U.S. And that has to be documented. That has to be verified. So you don't have to have that with these, you know, new sorts of offerings, these tokenized asset offerings, as I like to say, not ICO. But so you can invest $10. You can invest $10,000. You can invest $10 million. But you can get the same amount of return on your money that the wealthy people get, right? Because they're used to getting that kind of return because they're accredited investors. But now the average person can get that multiple of return. And that's a really big idea because that builds wealth on a global basis. So that's why I'm very high on this as a construct. However, you know, we're working with, say, for instance, a private equity real estate firm in Boston called Muirfield. They'll be launching their TAO within, you know, the next couple of weeks. Now, what they've done is they've said, okay, our job is to bring in money from investors to then build real estate or turn around real estate assets. And then 9 years later, when the fund is closed, we give them their returns, anywhere from 5 to 9 years is a private equity fund timeline. So now, as it's been tokenized, if you're in Haiti as a non-US investor and you invest in your field when it comes out, you can put in as little or as much as you want. But when you do, within 90 days, not 5 years, not 9 years, you can take that token and you can trade that token if you want to on any exchanges that exist in the world. But that takes the Muirfield token, and there will be several. But you know, that's the kind of democratization of investing that we just didn't have before. That was not accessible to nearly anybody in Haiti until this phenomenon started. Now, Haitians and anybody else who is, may not have all the money in the world, but says, okay, let me risk $50 or $500 or whatever to try to make more money, put my money to work like wealthy people do, which is why they get wealthier. Well, then now is your opportunity. And that's not so far-fetched. I'll tell you why. In the U.S., in Chicago and in New York, on Wall Street and on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, on the trading floor were usually younger people who didn't even graduate high school. They weren't stupid people. They just didn't have a Harvard education or four-year college education. So they started on the floor trading. And those of them that became good traders made a lot of money. They could make $1 million a year. They could do anything. They could take care of their families and put their kids in college and do whatever. If they weren't any more intelligent than anywhere else in the world. If you look in Asia, Africa, Haiti, anywhere, Hawaii, wherever, you have people who run bazaar stands. You know, you have open air markets where people are trading goods every day. It's the same principle. So once you have access to a trading platform that allows you to understand the value of the tokens that you're trading, well, then all of a sudden you're on the same level as everybody else. And that's very important to understand.
Wow, that's very powerful. Thank you for that. The other thing that I want to, I guess, ask you is, so what do you see on the horizon? Any interesting blockchains that you see on the right? What's the next? I know Ripple has been sort of like, people have been talking about it quite a bit. But do you see, is there anything that you see that you can share, like in terms of where this is going to, what cryptocurrency will be in the next 6 months or even a year from now? Not that
well,
you can predict, but just kidding.
I just want to qualify, I'm not a financial advisor.
We realize
when
that.
When I say this, everyone take it with a grain of salt. But
okay.
It's hard to say. I right now, there's a lot of, and I'll be very honest with your audience and with you, the majority of ICOs that are creating new assets are not going to work, okay? They're simply not going to work. This is the same as it was in the beginning of the internet days. There are lots of protocols that simply didn't work. And then, but that gave us the Googles and the Amazons of the world after the crash of 1999-2000. So there will be platforms that do rise up out of the ashes of this. Right now, let's just say I like platforms like EOS, EOS. I like platforms like NEO in China, NEO. They all do certain things. I suggest you research them. Their information is well documented and online. I'm not a big fan of Ripple, which is the XRP token. But Ripple was designed to use with banks to unify banks and create certain efficiencies. But it really is not living up to what it professed to be able to do. But they're very good marketers. So it doesn't mean the XRP token won't work. They're really stellar marketers. But marketing isn't the whole thing. It really has to work. So I would also say that be on the lookout. You know, there are sites you can go to, websites you can go to. Just Google or search for ICO watch list, and you'll get a number of sites that will explain the new ICOs that are coming out. They'll explain why they exist. They'll tell you who's involved. Some of them give you a risk assessment, like this one seems pretty risky or this one seems pretty solid. And then you can begin to make your own decisions about what works for you from an investment standpoint. EOS, NEO, I like personally. There are lots of others out there that people like, but most of them I'm not very enthusiastic about, quite frankly. I will tell you one. As a matter of fact, I think that they should go visit Haiti that I am involved with. It's called Impact PPA, which is a company that uses blockchain to deliver on-demand electricity at a very, very competitive rate, super competitive rate. That's something if anybody wants to look at, just Google Impact PPA and read about that, because that is germane to areas like Haiti.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I'm definitely, because anyone who follows me on social media knows that is something that's been on my heart. And it seems like there's some movements in Haiti where the president is trying to provide 24-hour electricity to everyone, but all of us are waiting. Nothing has happened yet. But last year, I actually had the vice president who's actually providing electricity, but he's only providing electricity in one area of Haiti, which is Mont-Saint-Nicolas. And I am so glad you shared that, because I think this is a conversation that more of the Haitian diaspora, they are interested in, because all of us want Haiti to have 24-hour electricity, because we understand that that's the only way that the country will be able to develop. As long as people remain in the dark, you are not going to have a developed country. So I am so glad. And what I will do, because I'm going to just sort of like quick summaries on social media. I will also include these lists on the show notes so people can actually have access to them pretty easily. I guess we are wrapping up. Thank you so much for giving me more time than I actually anticipated. So I'm really appreciative of that. So where can people find you? What's your website? What's your Twitter handle? I just want to make sure I let people know.
Sure. The Twitter handle is at Agentic Group, A-G-E-N-T-I-C Group. And the website is under construction. Our new website will be up in about 10 days, but that's agenticgroup.com, www.agenticgroup.com.
Great. Awesome. Okay, so let's see. I'm just checking my board to see if there are any questions. There doesn't seem to be any. We are going to wrap up again. Ms. Varela, thank you so much. I really appreciate this conversation. And please, I hope that we can actually stay in touch with you. You're doing a lot of work in the emerging market, at least from your bio. So I'm really excited about that because Haiti is part of the emerging market.
Absolutely.
At least that's what we're working towards. So I'm hoping that Haiti will continue to be part of that conversation. Any last minute insight? Any last minute words that you want to share before we actually close?
Yes, I would just say, look, don't be afraid of technology. I know that it seems daunting to some people. Even people in my own family or friends of mine have said, well, I don't know anything about that. Yes, you do. If you decide that you're going to do it, you can do it. Don't be afraid of it. It's going to be okay. As a matter of fact, use it to your advantage. That's what I'd like to tell everyone.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much again for this conversation. I'm thrilled, and I hope that eventually, as you continue to grow the space, because you're really sort of like one of the leading thinkers in this area, and you're practicing what you're doing with your firm, that we can keep following your work and hopefully have you back. So thank you again, and I appreciate it. And for everyone else who's listening, if you enjoyed tonight's show, please share it, and I will actually have the I will have it up in the next day or so for all of you to listen on my blog as well. And Ms. Varela, thank you so much for your time, and I appreciate it. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
No problem. Good night.